From the Bardic College. In AD&D 1st Edition, in addition to other languages, each character knew the alignment language that matched their alignment. That means that if you are lawful good, you knew a language known as lawful good. The 1st Edition Dungeon Master's Guide proceeds to explain that people are socially stigmatized for speaking alignment languages in public. And of course, no one will risk using their alignment language with people that aren't their alignment around them. I guess this explains why later editions no longer had alignment languages. If you can only speak to people that you know already speak your language, but you can't speak your language to ask them, then I'm pretty sure the gods of logic babbled those languages out of existence since they were completely unusable.
And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time and podcasting for 2 years, as of this episode, 2 years! While we both love lots of other RPGs, D&D speaks our language. Hi, I'm Ange, and I've been gaming for over 35 years. We won't talk about how much over 35 years. In 2014, I started writing for Gnome Stew, and I've been running the Gnomecast since about 2017. And eventually, I became head gnome, and there we are.
And I'm Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew, and I have seen 7 editions of D&D. In addition to writing reviews at Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoiknowgr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs. After we look at the games that we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about using languages in D&D. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
So, as might be expected, I have not played any D&D in quite some time. I did get to attend Origins a few weeks ago in June, which is why you guys got Chris on the last episode. While I didn't play D&D, I did get to play a whole bunch of other games. I got in a little bit of Fate. I got some Savage Worlds, some Mutants and Masterminds, plus a homebrew game, and I also got to run Vaesen and the Electric State from Free League. All in all, it was a fantastic time. I should add in there, I also, before Origins, got to attend a wedding. I attended the wedding of the GM who runs the Monkeys Will Kill You, the Cygnus de Gur campaign that I was telling you about. And I found out at the rehearsal dinner that I was best woman and I was in charge of the rings. They're like, okay, Ange, you're going to stand next to Scott and you're going to give him the rings when the officiant asks for it. And I'm like, I am? Like, I knew they wanted me to give a toast, but I wasn't quite expecting that level of honor. So, you know, it's all planning in D&D. It's how this goes. You step up and do the job when you need to.
They Frodo Rivendell'd you. Carry the ring.
The best part, too, is the mother of the bride came and she handed me the box with the rings in it and gave me the very specific instructions. She's like, you must take out Billy's first, because if you take out Scott's first, Billy's ring will go flying and then the day will be ruined. And she's like, and you must guard this with your life. You have one job. And the first thing I did was set it down and then walk into another room and forget where I had put it. So thankfully, I fixed that right away. Anyway, back to Origins. All in all, it was a really good time. Me and my friends spent a fair amount of time talking about the types of games we like to play at conventions. And while there are a couple of folks in my extended group who don't really care for D&D or that traditional type of fantasy, most of us do enjoy a good D&D game, but that's not what we look for at conventions. I joke, no, you can't play D&D at the convention. We have D&D at home. But I'm partially serious. There are a ton of different ways to play D&D, and it can be hard to tell what kind of game you're going to be getting based on just a short blurb in the events app. I had a friend who ended up playing a 5e game at Origins that she found a bit disappointing. Her description was, to quote, 2 lines of narrative, 90 minutes of combat, 2 more lines of narrative, and then an hour of combat. And while that might suit some people's jam, she was looking more to engage with the role-playing and the story of the game, and that can be it can be really hard to get at a convention with D&D because you never know exactly what you're going to get. To be fair, I find the same issue with superhero games. I play superhero games because I enjoy the story and the narrative. And yes, I like punching evil in the face. But sometimes if you pick these games at conventions, you just get a combat, you know, a 4-hour combat, which is the problem I ran into when I chose a Marvel Multiverse RPG game to play at Origins. It was kind of disappointing because it was literally a combat, and like he had to have minis set up for even the tiniest of encounter with just like two Hydra agents when you've got Captain America, Jessica Jones, Wolverine, Spider-Man, and Black Widow. We didn't need the minis for a two Hydra agent scene.
But I mean, to be fair, nothing is going to live up to our Marvel team up with Venom and She-Hulk.
No, not at all. It was fantastic.
So unfortunately, last Thursday I was sick. So our protagonists are still poised on the edge of Set's domain. And we didn't resolve anything in my Midgard game yet. However, I did manage to run another Saturday game for my group that is playing Curse of Strahd. So I will say this up front, because I know even though Curse of Strahd has been out like forever, it's a perpetually well-liked and utilized adventure. So there's going to be a few spoilers in here. So if you are one of the people that still wants to engage in Curse of Strahd and have not yet, there's going to be spoilers here. So check back in a few minutes. They're all still kind of getting dialed in with their knowledge of D&D, and there's only three of them. So one of the things that I have been doing mechanically is giving all of the monsters their minimum hit points. I don't know if you have looked through the Death House adventure in Curse of Strahd, but for some reason, they really want first level characters to die in this. There are some monsters there that I was like, you did not put that in a first level adventure, did you? I haven't been swapping out monsters because my thought is a lot of lower CR monsters, when you drop their hit points to the minimum, they're going to take them out in one or two hits, but I kind of still want them to hit hard enough to scare them.
Yeah.
It's been working pretty well. The last session, they finished up in the attic. They took a long rest. They found the trap door that led into the catacombs beneath Death House. So we started from them starting to wander through those catacombs. It was really interesting because we ended up with a lot of questions about resting. And this was kind of an interesting back and forth to get them used to this paradigm, because I told them, if you want to take a rest, I'm going to roll a d20 for every hour that you rest. And if we roll above a certain number, something is going to find you while you're resting. So they were doing a lot of this risk versus reward and trying to figure out, okay, if we backtrack here to this bedroom that we found, we can rest here for an hour and then, you know, we'll get back our hit points and everything. Then we'll head back out again. There was even a point later on where they were like, okay, we really want to take a long rest to get everything back before we go to the next level of the dungeon, because there's another level beneath the catacombs. And I was like, okay, but if you take a long rest, we're going to be rolling this die 8 times. So what was funny is they ended up, because their cleric is an elf, they decided they didn't want to risk 8 hours, but the blood hunter and the monk weren't as worried about getting a long rest. So they risked the 4 hours and they barricaded themselves into the bedroom, and we rolled the die 4 times and they were okay. And they were really thrilled about that.
But that does a really good job of kind of ramping up the tension of, you are not in a safe space.
Yeah.
You can't just put your head down on a pillow and expect to wake up unmolested in the morning.
Yeah, I don't want to tell them they can't rest, but I do want there to be some thought that goes into, should we do this or not?
Yeah.
This could be very bad. And I even explained to them, like, if you are taking a long rest and you get interrupted, then you may have to start over again. So then, you know, you're risking all this all over again. That worked out really well. The other thing that I noticed is we had a lot of death saves going on this time. Turns out, even when you drop ghouls down to their minimum hit points, they still get 3 attacks per round. So,
oh yeah,
that's pretty rough for a second level character.
Yeah, that's brutal.
our changeling blood hunter went down. The monk finished off the ghoul. They retreated. That was their first short rest. And they got to learn all about the fun of spending hit dice. Then later on, the blood hunter went down again, I believe. And then in the lower catacombs, there is this big ritual room. And in the big ritual room, there's a shambling mound that is waiting to come out and attack you, which is really rough for second level characters.
Yeah.
And the thing is, with the shambling mound, even cutting it to its minimum hit points for a shambling mound are not as low as they are for a ghoul because, you know, they're still getting their constitution bonus on every hit die. That one was a little rough. I was a little worried about that. On top of that, what was amusing is that our blood hunter did the Crimson Rite thing where she, you know, damages herself and she gets to add bonus damage and she got to pick her damage type. She said these words. I wanted to stop her. And then I was like, no, I can't. She was like, well, we've been running into all of these different undead. I'm going to pick lightning damage because surely nothing down here is going to be immune to lightning damage.
Oh, no.
At which point, after the monk had attacked the shambling mound, she uses her attack and heals it with the lightning damage that she did.
Oh, like it would be one thing if you as the GM kind of prevaricated and prevented them from acknowledging some clues that showed that lightning damage would be bad. No, no, they had absolutely no way of knowing there was a shambling mound down there.
No, there really wasn't. And I was like, you know, I don't want to kill them off, but I also don't want them to think that, you know, there aren't going to be surprises every once in a while when you run into something and have no idea what it does. That fight was pretty brutal because the shambling mound would drop somebody to zero and start absorbing them. And then the cleric would healing word them and they would break out. And then that would happen to the monk. Then the blood hunter would come up and hit it. They would drop to zero. It would pick up the blood hunter and start absorbing them. And then the cleric would do healing word and get the blood hunter out again. I was a little lenient because technically, I believe if they're being absorbed, you can't see them. And I ruled that, no, the cleric can see them because she needs to be able to see them to do healing word. So it's like, yeah, some part of them is sticking out. It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't going to be that vicious to them. That's not good. But yes, there were many, many death saves. And I believe the blood hunter was up to 2 failed death saves one time. There was this was interesting too. There was a moment where the cleric was like, well, I want to do something, but I don't know if I should stop and heal her first. And I was like, okay, here's the thing. If she rolls a 1 on that death save, that's 2 failures. So she's already failed 1. If she rolls a 1 this next time, she's dead. And they risked that one, and, you know, she only got 1 failure.
Don't risk the next one.
No, not at all. We had kind of a moment where I almost caused myself to cry because the elf was carrying the spirits of the 2 kids that died up in the attic with her, and they found the catacombs where, you know, their bodies were at. And I started describing how, you know, they curled up in their crypt and, you know, looked like they were laying down to take a nap. That was one of those things. I start describing it and then like my own description starts, you know, hitting me in the feels and going, what the hell did I just say? It was funny though, because later on, when they ran into the kids' parents that had turned into ghasts, they were not merciful or nice at all to these parents. But when you get to the bottom there is this chanting that basically tells you that you need to sacrifice someone or else the house won't let you leave. And obviously, they really didn't want to sacrifice one of them, you know, a member of the party. So they refused to do that. And at that point, the house turns hostile. Like, all of the doors turn into blade traps. All of the rooms that have fireplaces in them start filling up with smoke. They start running to get out of the house. There is a statue of Strahd that if you take the crystal ball that it's holding, it releases, I think it's 6 or 8 shadows. It doesn't matter whether it's 6 or 8 because like 1 shadow can kill a first level party. So on the way through, as they're running to get out of this house, the blood hunter says, I'm going to grab that on the way out. That'll be fine. So she grabs it and I explain that all of these shadows just start pouring out from behind the statue. At which point they were all very freaking out. It says to keep people in initiative, and I was, but I wasn't measuring like exact distances. It was sort of like, okay, this round you can get to this room. You know, this round you can, you know, get to this room. As we were doing that, I was like, the shadows are 1 room behind you. if you have any problems getting through one of these trap doors, they're going to catch up with you. So the cleric was like, well, can I use, you know, I have minor image. Can I do something like make us look like we're crawling through like a crawl space and trick them? And I was like, you know what? I don't need to mechanically model this. I am fine with them saying, yeah, that'll get you an extra room's worth of distance between you and the shadows. Like, they're going to catch up with that illusion, realize there's something wrong. They don't feel any life force in it, and they keep chasing you. But now you have two rooms between you and where these shadows are at, you know, for you to get out. And they finally make their way out of the front. They were really banged up. The blood hunter had a level of exhaustion from breathing in all the smoke from the different rooms. They got out of the house. They see all the mist part. They see the road that leads up to Barovia, and they see the Vistani camp that is, you know, right outside of the house now. They go in there, they talk to Stanimir, and instead of just taking them straight in to do the reading with Madam Eva, they were like, we really need a long rest. And I was like, yes, the Vistani will extend their hospitality. You can rest in this caravan for tonight. And then we're going to start the next session with you doing the reading from Madam Eva. So I'm excited because I get to use my Taroka deck next time. It was a lot of fun, though.
It sounds like it was a great session.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
Moving on into our Dungeon Master's Workshop. From the earliest days in D&D, one of the steps of character creation has been determining what languages characters know. Many of D&D's languages end up being very broad, with entire species speaking the same language. Due to the common language, sometimes those other languages don't seem as useful as they might otherwise. We're going to take a look at languages in D&D and what you can do with them. Experiences with languages in different editions of D&D. What are the differences between the various editions?
One of the biggest things that I noticed is that first edition was really weird with some of the rules around how many languages you knew, because it was measured by your intelligence score, but also different races could not learn certain languages because D&D first edition is real stupid about stuff like that. So, for example, if you're an elf or a human or a half elf, you know, if you have a high intelligence score, you can learn all the languages that your intelligence should let you learn.
You know, thinking about this, like, if somebody who doesn't speak English can learn to speak English fluently, anyone can learn any language. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. But yeah, so like the elves and the half elves and the humans, you can learn all the way up to your intelligence, you know, limit in languages. Gnomes and dwarves. You can know the languages that we told you are common for your species to know, and two extra ones. No matter how intelligent you are, you never get more than two extra languages. But at least you can still learn all of that stuff like Dwarven and Gnomish and Goblin and all that stuff that you know we're saying is common for you. If you are a half-orc, screw you, because you can never know more than two languages ever.
You basically get orc and common.
Yeah, it's the stupidest thing ever. I really hate some of the little reinforcing things that they were trying to do with some of these rules in first edition.
I mean, there's a reason I came back to D&D with third edition. Third edition has some issues, but one of the things it didn't have issues with was that kind of BS.
Yeah.
Because in there, it was simply based on what your intelligence was.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't do a deep dive into this, but my gut feeling is I don't think they had some of those same limits in second edition. I don't think they went into that. I mean, there were still some dumb, you can't go above this level if you're this, you know, if you're this race taking this class things and that. But all of those were, for one thing, all of those were higher in second edition. And I do think they ratcheted back some of this stuff. Like, we're not trying to tell you that somehow being smart for a half-orc is still dumber than everybody else, which is just annoying as all get out.
I mean, of course, back in second edition, no one could possibly imagine you wanting to play a smart half-orc for any reason at all.
Yeah.
Why? You can't be a wizard. There's nothing it gets you.
But what's even funnier is in those editions, we weren't even doing point buy. So you could randomly roll really well for your intelligence, but you're still being punished for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you said, we get into third edition and you get a certain number of languages based on your intelligence bonus. And The other thing that you have in third edition that you really didn't have in previous editions is you can spend your skill points as you're leveling up to learn more languages. So there's not really a ceiling on the total number of languages. It's more, do I want to spend these skill points that I desperately need somewhere else to learn a language?
I don't remember this. Were there feats in third edition that let you take additional languages?
I do believe that there were a few feats that did that. Like you learn three languages and, you know, something like that.
Something like linguist or something along those lines. But again, that was one of those, oh, do you really, really want to put waste a feat on languages?
That's really been the thing is that when I've made characters, when I like to play characters, when I want a character to feel intelligent in a D&D world, especially, I like them knowing a lot of languages.
Yeah.
It's weird because even though it's not always functional, it makes me feel good to be able to say, well, yes, I speak to them in their native deep speech and scare everybody with those weird noises.
Now, in fifth edition, it's essentially just based on background and class.
Yep.
I don't believe the intelligence factors into it, although I do think probably bards and wizards get more languages. I don't remember. Don't quote me on this.
I don't think that they necessarily do automatically. You do have like the things like Thieves' Cant and Druidic that are just part of the class features. We have moved away from this because at the beginning of 5th edition, you didn't get all the languages that you did in earlier editions, but like different races got extra languages. Usually they got their own plus common, so they had that one extra one.
Right.
And now that's not necessarily assumed because we're not assuming that your dwarf grew up among dwarves. Your dwarf may have grown up among humans, which is cool. But it also means we're not just assuming that you know dwarf and common both.
Yeah.
You may have to spend one of your other languages to get that. However, there's a lot of backgrounds that give you extra languages too.
Yes, yes. So what are some of the special rules that are connected to language in D&D?
For one thing, like we were talking about, intelligence has been linked before and then not linked anymore. And you do have now in 5th edition, one of the downtime things that you can take is learning a language. And intelligence still kind of figures into this because it takes you a little bit less time to learn a language if your intelligence is higher than if your intelligence is lower, but it doesn't limit the number of languages you know. It just takes you more downtime. But also, if you're not using downtime a whole lot, you're not picking up extra languages. What was kind of cool in previous editions is in the AD&D 2nd edition, in the Time of the Dragon box set for Dragonlance, there was a chart that showed how all languages were related. And there was a line between those two. And for each dot, if you were trying to understand a language, you would subtract one from your check to understand something in that other language. So like between two different elf languages, there might be like one dot.
I think that is fascinating, and I'm surprised they haven't carried it through to later editions of D&D, because if you look at the source material that tends to inspire D&D, there's a lot about languages in them. Like Tolkien, I mean, he was a freaking linguist. Half of what he did was designing the languages that the elves spoke and, you know, like all of this. And it was a huge foundation of what he did, even if it didn't necessarily end up coming into play in the story directly for the characters. Not the Game of Thrones, Song of Fire and Ice is directly D&D inspiration, but there's still a whole lot done with languages in there.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, it's language tends to be a thing that's very important in the literature that inspires D&D.
And I'm sure Professor Tolkien would be scandalized if you told him there is one language that all elves speak. That is not true in Middle Earth.
No, he would be like, that doesn't make any sense. Why would you do that?
But they migrated. It would change. But yeah, I kind of like that system because it was neat just to trace that line, because it was like, okay, it's a long shot, but the ogre language on this continent is slightly influenced by the ice people that live near them. So I have, you know, I can roll at -5 and maybe pick up those few words that ogres share with the ice folk. And figure out how to talk to them.
I mean, it makes sense. If you look at the way languages exist in our world, that's how they're connected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is much easier for somebody who speaks a language, like a Germanic language, like English or German, to learn something that's in that same family. You know, if there was a Latin influence, and I don't mean Latin America or anything like that, I mean, like actual Latin, like the thing you use to summon demons. If there's a Latin influence in your language, then it makes it easier to go back and forth. But if you try and go learn something that's completely different, like somebody in England trying to learn Japanese or Chinese, it's a very, very different language. It takes a lot more work. I have a great deal of respect for the people who are multilingual like that.
Yeah, and it goes back to that whole idea of, like, I like the prestige of knowing extra languages, even if it's not always practical. The other rules that you have is, like we'd mentioned before, if you're a rogue, you get thieves cant automatically. And I want to revisit that later in this discussion. If you're a druid, you learn druidic, and like through every edition, what's been really funny is they always say druids jealously guard this language. If you are not a druid, you're not allowed to speak this language according to druids. And also now in fifth edition, it's really easy to pick up druidic if you aren't a druid.
We guard it closely, but you're special. You can get it.
Then the other things that I kind of like are these quirky things where some species like gnomes or goliaths, the way they phrase their abilities are like, you know, the language of burrowing animals. And I just love this idea. It's not them saying that you can speak with animals. It is literally, you understand the language of burrowing animals.
You get to have tea with the groundhog.
Yes. And oddly, I can picture a gnome just sitting there and having a conversation with the groundhog.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We're talking about D&D here. Spells are an integral part of D&D, which means there's going to be spells that deal with language in D&D. So talk to me about spells and language.
It's really funny about this. You know, we've talked about this before. After decades and decades of playing D&D, there are still those things that you can't keep straight in your brain. And every so often, I have to stop and remind myself, what does comprehend languages do, and what does tongues do?
See, I thought comprehend languages let you listen to somebody speaking the language.
It is written word.
Well, I'm not going to tell anyone they're doing it wrong, because that's the way I've been doing it, so...
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, though. So, but basically, there are these baseline spells where it's like, you cast this spell, you can read whatever, you know, in whatever language. You cast this other spell, you can listen to and converse with people in any language. And then you have the things that let you talk to people or things or creatures, like speak with animals or speak with plants, that aren't necessarily a language per se, but it allows language to transfer between you and the bushes outside of the outside of the blacksmith's house.
I'm going to throw in a Baldur's Gate 3 tangent here and talk about how it is incredibly important to either have a character that can speak with animals or make sure you gather and hoard every single speak with animals potion you find. Because this is a Larian Studios game, and they make sure that almost every single animal you can interact with will have a conversation with you. And a couple of times it's really important. There's a dog, and you need speak with animals to do everything right to get the dog to be your friend. And everybody wants the dog to be your friend. And if you don't, and if you're a bad person who does bad things to the dog, I don't know what you are, because that's not good.
The other thing that kind of gets me when we look at these spells, and then looking back to what we were talking about with like gnomes knowing how to speak with burrowing animals, that's been one of the things that I'm not as thrilled with some of the 2024 changes, because in order to make things simpler and more utilitarian, some things get reduced to like very simple terms. So you have something like, well, we just want to be able to say gnomes can speak with animals. And it's like, that is not the same backstory as you speak the language of burrowing animals. And
yeah.
I realize that is utilitarian. It references the rules, but it feels less interesting to me.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. I'm going to go back to comprehend languages for a moment, because the one thing I will say on it is we have always played it as it lets you understand a language, but mm-hmm. you can't speak it. So we've used it before where we've had somebody cast comprehend languages and listen to a conversation. And I think comprehend is something you get at, do you get that at first level or is that second? And I think tongues is a much higher level spell.
I am dumb, and we could kill this whole thing about comprehend languages, because it is, you know, written languages, you can listen and understand. You cannot make yourself understood.
Oh.
So, yes, I did bad. I bad research me.
I mean, it's still good. It's still good. But now you know, and knowing is half the battle.
Yes.
But again, if you're playing Baldur's Gate 3, make sure you have speak with animals yeah. in any form you can, because some of the animals are freaking hilarious. You need to speak to every single cat in the city.
You know, the other thing that's funny to me, though, is one of the reasons I don't get as used to the language spells is because common is so useful in D&D to the point to where it is too useful and languages don't come up as much as they should.
We're moving on to a new question. It's like, how have you used languages in D&D as a dungeon master? And I think it is important to talk about how language, it can be a very cool narrative element to the game. It can also be a huge pain in the butt, depending upon how the GM is using it, how the players are using it. And it's hard to find the right balance between making the world feel lived in with different languages and, you know, different cultures, but also not block your players from engaging with the people they're meeting and the towns, the places they're exploring and all of that. So how do we do that?
Yeah, I was gonna say that's the danger, is when you tell people they are expressly using a language that you are not likely to have, then it becomes this risk-reward thing of, do we need to worry about whether we can talk to them or not? And you, as the DM, kind of want to communicate to them, yes, you do want to talk to them, but those characters aren't going to be saying, yes, you need to talk to me.
Right.
One of the things that I've done a lot with language has just been writing. I think that's one of the things that's probably the easiest to have someone use their language skills for, because it's a lot easier to say, you find a book in ancient Netherese, and your common is not going to help you because you're not talking to the person that wrote the book. You're reading the book, so you have to know Netherese yeah. in order to understand that book.
Yeah.
But yeah, as far as like getting people to speak to someone, this is where I do kind of wish there was that follow the line and subtract the dots so that you have a chance to guess at what you're saying if you don't have a common language. One of the things that I loved was when I ran Storm King's Thunder, our Goliath Paladin that worked for the Lord's Alliance did not speak common. He expressly made a character that did not speak common.
We had an interesting conversation in my Depths of Zendrick game where one of the character was playing a drow from Zendrick who accidentally got teleported to Corvair, where he kind of built a life and now is his opportunity to return. And we had a long conversation about the nature of the origin of Elvish and Giant, because the story in Eberron is that the elves were subjugated by the giants until that empire fell apart. And then the elves kind of separated, and you have some that went north to Arinol, and you had some that stayed. The drow are the ones that stayed. And the question was, do the drow speak Elvish or do the drow speak Giant?
Mm-hmm.
We kind of debated about it a little bit, and I'm like, well, Elvish is going to be coming out of whatever this language is, so we're going to just call it Elvish for now, but there is a big giant influence. in this particular language.
That is a really interesting point, too, because I dearly, dearly love 5th edition. I do not hesitate in saying it is my favorite edition of D&D. However, it very much tried to simplify certain things, and languages are one of those. It used to be that Drow had their own separate version of Elvish, and now Drow just speak either Elvish or Undercommon.
Yeah.
And I think that is less interesting than having Drow know their own language, because it makes sense that the Drow language would be an amalgam of Elvish and other things that altered over time.
Well, as you said, Professor Tolkien would be horrified that Elvish is this monolithic language.
And one of the things that I did in third edition was in the Forgotten Realms campaign setting book, which was really awesome. There were like six different regions that the Faerunian continent was broken up into. And those all kind of had languages that were native to that region. If you were in, say, around Baldur's Gate or up through Am, Tatherian is a language that, you know, a lot of people would speak. And the way I usually played this was, yes, if you are an adventurer or a traveling merchant or a diplomat or a politician, you probably know common. If you are a person that sells bread on the street, you speak whatever language is common in that country. So, like, when you wanted to have conversations with just regular people that weren't adventurers, that weren't, you know, someone like that, you know, you kind of needed to know these other languages in order to communicate with regular people. But that was also something that I kind of had to set at the beginning of the campaign to let people know this is how I'm doing this, because even in third edition, when they had those extra languages, there was still this kind of feeling that you're defaulting to, yeah, everybody knows common unless they're a monster that lives somewhere out in the wilderness.
I have conflicting thoughts on this, because I've heard this explanation of what common is before, that it's a quote unquote trade language, but it can get complicated if the players are really getting into the role playing. And how do I want to phrase this? They're having conversations that you could not have in a trade language. Mm-hmm. Because a trade language is supposed to be very simple, very direct,
yeah,
and cover just kind of the economy and transactional things. It's not something you can have poetry in.
Yeah, you're not going to be talking philosophy in that.
Yeah, and so I like that idea, but it can get very complicated. So I think it depends very much on the type of game you're running. If I'm running Dragon Heist and it's based in Waterdeep, or you're even running, I think Tyranny of the Dragon Queen mostly sticks to the Sword Coast.
If you're
playing something that sticks to a region, most people are speaking the same language and you call it out when it's important that somebody is speaking something different. If you're playing a game where the goal is a very long journey across multiple lands in multiple cultures, lean into that, because you can use that trade language to communicate with some people, but you're still going to have some issues learning how to talk to the people that live in these new areas, these new foreign areas that you've never been before.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that was kind of fun, and like when I was running, you know, in Forgotten Realms in third edition, because when I had my really long running game that went up to like 13th level, they were in like near Cormyr and the Dale Lands, and Cormyr and the Dale Lands and Sembia, that area generally has Chondathan as like a native language from like the older countries that they're all descended from. So it was kind of cool because I would let them know, like, most of your conversations are in Chondathan. You're probably not using common because people in Cormyr speak Chondathan, people in Sembia speak Chondathan. There's no reason for you to do common here. But when you go and travel to the other side, you know, when you go across Anorak and you start talking to people like near Baldur's Gate or whatever, they don't speak Chondathan there. So you're going to have to either do common or you're going to need to learn Tatherian.
Yeah.
But like you said, that's one of those background things that can take a lot of effort.
Right.
Even in our campaign now in Moraea, there's like two different languages that all of you guys should probably be speaking. I don't think we reference that very often.
Well, one of the other things you need to keep in mind if you want to do something like this is you need to either just give those languages for free, you know, give extra languages to your players,
mm-hmm.
because you need to make it clear up front that it's more than the languages that are listed in the player's handbook when the players are making their characters. If I need to know these regional languages for these different cultures, I want to know that up front. I don't want to be taken by surprise, you know, because I ended up taking Common, Elvish, Draconic, and Halfling.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I need to know Chindathan and all these other languages. And I'm like, I didn't know that was on the menu, man.
Right, yeah. And the thing about that is on one hand, I think D&D tends to hand out languages really easily. But on the other hand, because we already know that this isn't something that is baked into it, if you give someone an extra language, it does not break anything.
Yeah.
Language is one of those things you can hand out and it's not going to damage a thing.
I know when I ran my original Eberron campaign, Veterans of the Gauntlet, they traveled to Arganessen and they were specifically going to a city that's kind of center of the continent where people live, you know, where humans and elves and some dwarves and some other, you know, folks live. And it's not just dragons. It's kind of a little bit of a protected city. And I made it very clear to most of the players that your character's not going to know the language because common is not going to be a thing. But one of the characters was from there and they were going there because they needed to, they were searching for an artifact. But since he was from there, he was their guide. And they very specifically said on the journey from the shore where they landed, trekking through the jungles and then the plains, he was teaching them the language so that they would have mm-hmm. enough of it so that they could converse with people. So it still was a point of the narrative, but it wasn't something that got in the way of them engaging with the content in this new city. Because that's one thing you don't necessarily want to do is you don't want to have only one character in the party be able to speak the language and then have a whole bunch of content that character has to be present for, because otherwise you're screwed.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Also, I kind of wanted to talk before we move into some of our other questions here about how to use things. One of the things that's interesting about 5th edition, which is a little bit different than what they have said in other editions, and this goes along with my favorite thing to mention that isn't actually my favorite thing, and that is the setting is the multiverse. And one of the things that is now true of the setting is the multiverse is common is the same common in every reality and every place across the multiverse, which would probably make Professor Tolkien's head explode. That to me feels way too broad, because that is basically saying that somehow the gods got together and said, you will not learn another language. You will learn common on Ancelon in Kryn, and it will be the exact same common that they know in the Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, I think whatever designer wrote that section is somebody who had a very, very bad experience with a GM who completely screwed over the game with language minutiae.
And the thing is, I think there are ways to work around those potential language problems that are more flavorful, because I can totally see that if you end up in like Sigil in Planescape, you know the language everyone else is speaking because that's a property of Sigil. Then you don't have to say common is the same common everywhere. It is just that no one in Sigil is supposed to not understand someone else in Sigil.
Was it a Star Trek episode, a recent Star Trek episode? I think it was an episode of Discovery where they were talking about how, no, the universal translator just translates everyone. Everyone is talking in their uh-huh. native tongue. And then they turned it off for a second and talked at each other and was like, whoa, because universal translator, it's just translating everybody. You're not learning any new language. You can just talk to everybody.
That is an interesting thing to me, that common is that broad. So that is a thing where I am not advocating that you have to do this the way the official rules say that it works.
Yeah, I mean, again, it depends on how complicated you want to make things. If you've got a beer and pretzels table that just wants to punch monsters in the face and, you know, do bold, crazy things, you may not want to dig too deep into the language stuff. But if you have players that enjoy the role playing, enjoy the story, enjoy the narrative, maybe don't do the everyone's common is everyone's common. So what are some other things we can do to languages? Because we've covered a lot, but what are some things we can do to languages to make them more meaningful in D&D?
One of the things that is interesting is that whether or not you can communicate with someone, I think it's good to introduce some NPCs that are better disposed towards you if you speak their language or you speak a language they prefer.
Yes.
And this is actually something that's true in our game, and I haven't played it up as much. And part of the reason I haven't played it up as much is because you all have a lot of contacts that aren't from the Dragon Empire. But if you are talking to someone that has occupied Moraea and they are from the Dragon Empire and you are not speaking Draconic to them, they'll understand you. They may communicate with you. They are definitely looking down on you.
So they're basically from Quebec. I say this with love. I have a friend from Quebec.
But yeah, I mean, I think that is an interesting way to use language, even if you don't want to create a barrier there. It gives you that extra thing where, like, you know, it is better to speak to them in a language they know. So maybe find the person in the party that speaks that language and let them do the talking for you. And we already talked about defining what common is in your game. If you don't want it to be the same as the default, one of the things that was kind of interesting, yeah, we talked about the trade language. If it's a trade language, who knows it? Because just because your adventurers know something does not mean everyone in the setting knows something.
Right.
And that's something I think we sometimes forget. We're thinking, oh, I'm making up this adventure. This is the way everyone in the world works. No, you're an adventurer. You are not normal. And this was one of the things that I actually was asking around to clarify this, but in the assumption in Midgard, because it's a third party thing and it's not it's not necessarily tied to the same rules that WotC says, common is actually the language that developed in the Crossroads area. But because the Crossroads area is where everyone goes through, like if you're from the south and you're going to trade with the north or, you know, whatever direction you're moving, that is the language that a lot of people learn as their trade tongue. So it is an actual language, and it's a language for a region, but it is called common just because everybody passes through that region to, you know, to make their trades and do business and things like that.
So I mentioned earlier how in the real world, I joke that Latin is what you use to summon demons. Is there a language that is used for magic? Or have you ever thought about having a particular language that would be the basis of most of the somatic components of magic?
It's really funny because you would see it referenced, but I don't know that they ever said it like specifically and said, you have this language. But for a long time, like the Dragonlance books would assume, there is a specific language that all magic is written in. And it's not a language that anybody that isn't a wizard is supposed to be learning. And that's what all the spell books are in. That's what all of the, the verbal components to spells are in. So it was this very specific thing that the Orders of High Sorcery developed as their language for their profession. In that way, it's almost like a wizard version of Druidic, kind of. The other thing that I've seen a lot, and I do kind of like this, is Draconic is very often used as that, this is what most magic is in because we learned all this stuff from dragons to begin with.
I actually think I should probably put that into play in my Eberron game, because dragons gave magic to everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So it would make sense that magic is with Draconic. You know, and it would be the type of thing where, like, you know, no, you can't speak Draconic, but you know how to cast your spells. So, oh, hey, yeah, you understood the word that guy said.
And what's interesting about that is there is a real world precedent in that there are people that understand what Latin means, but you don't know how to speak Latin because it's a dead language.
Yeah, nobody speaks it. We're making it up as we go, man.
Exactly. Like, we know what these little bits mean when we put them together. We have no idea what people actually sounded like when they were doing these. Because now even the languages that are developed from Latin have drifted, far enough now.
Speaking of Latin, what languages would you have religious texts be written in?
What's neat about this is, we have a tool in D&D that we don't have in the real world that is kind of fun, and that is if you have a good religion, you know, of a deity that is supposed to be good, you can say that your holy texts are written in Celestial. And that is not going to be something that a common person can read, but that is probably something that the clergy will end up learning how to read. Or if you have maybe a nastier religion, it might be in an infernal. Or, you know, if you have more of a nature-based or elemental, it could be in primordial. And the thing is, too, with those planar languages, those don't bother me as much that those are a big language spoken across the multiverse, because that feels different to me. The fact that every angel across the multiverse speaks the same language makes more sense to me than every human across the multiverse. The other thing that's funny is, I was thinking about this, you could have your more chaotic, more evil religions write things down in Abyssal, but for some reason, I'm just picturing like Abyssal is just like a bunch of curses and insults and horrible profanity. Like, I have to go through a lot of this stuff before I even find what this is about. What is this bit about my mother? I don't understand. But there is a source that honestly I would tell people to go out and get, because this was absolutely wonderful. It is Arcadia issue 28 from MCDM, because there is an article by Leon Barillo, and the article is about D&D languages. And there is like a tree, and the tree that shows how the languages are related is something you could kind of use if you wanted to do like that Dragonlance thing, because you could trace through that root and say, okay, you are -1 for each, you know, branch that they're showing on this thing for your languages. But that's not the only thing that I love about that. It got into things like saying giant is often used for operas because giant is a language where you project a lot. And I'm like, that is so cool.
That is brilliant. Like, that is absolutely brilliant.
And it had a lot of things like that, where it was talking about how, yes, this is a language of a specific, you know, species, but it gets used by other species for these things. One of the things, I love this one, they were like, orcs are very direct. So if you ever want to lay out like a contract or instructions or something like that, you write it in orc because it is unambiguous. You can't misunderstand. If you understand Orcish and someone writes down something in Orcish, there is no doublespeak. There's, you know, it's just, you know.
And never, never, never get your instructions in Elvish.
Yeah.
Because the poetry and the flowery language and the, you know, the doublespeak is like, you'll never know what piece is supposed to go where.
And my favorite of these was, they were mentioning that in Infernal, every word in Infernal has two meanings, which change based on context.
Oh, of course Infernal would do that.
Yes. So you have to be very careful to know what context in which a word is meaning, because it literally means the exact opposite if you miss a bit of context in which it was spoken or written.
I hate demons and devils. Anyway.
Like I said, that's a fun article. I recommend you picking up Arcadia 28 because it's great. There's a few more rules around it. Like if you cast spells, if you know giant and you cast these certain spells, you get a little bit of a benefit. I don't know that I want to go that deep, but just the mindset behind some of the languages is great. So I recommend picking that up.
So we've covered some of this already, but what changes would you make to D&D languages?
Okay, so this is 100% Jared opinion that you're getting here now. So Thieves' Cant should be a meta language, not a language. And what I mean by that is, if two people that know Thieves' Cant get together and they both speak Elvish, they should be able to use certain words and phrases and gestures that they each understand, but they're speaking Elvish. It's not a separate language. It is a set of codes.
Thieves' Cant shouldn't be a separate language. It should be a mode of communication that certain people can basically use to communicate things. We actually did this in the game my friend Jen is running that's set in Faerun, but we're using Fate instead of D&D for reasons. And our two characters, there's two players, me and Andy, our two characters are young, we're teenagers, essentially. And we had a conversation with one of his mentors, who is a criminal, very obliquely, you know, telling us about thieves' cant and what certain symbols mean. And basically, like, if you see this symbol on the outside of a building, it means it's guarded. If you see this symbol, there's magic in there. If you see this symbol, it's not worth it. You know, it was a very cool scene to play out, and it gave a lot more meat to what thieves' cant is.
Yeah, and I also think it's fun because if you are a thief from one area and you speak common and someone else doesn't speak common, it's not as easy to speak thieves' cant with them because you don't have any words that you can use double entendres for or anything like that.
Right, and generally speaking, thieves' cant shouldn't be a fully universal language because it should be very specific to the underworld in whatever location you're at. But I would let players who have it use it to try and like figure out who the Thieves Guild is, who are the movers and shakers in the criminal underworld.
But yeah, that's my thing. I would make Thieves Cant a meta language. Another thing that I was thinking about just as we were talking about this is there were some references in the Forgotten Realms that there's like ranger signs. And what that is it's not like it's not a spoken language or anything, but it's sort of like Thieves Cant in that if you see like, you know, three rocks set at the base of a tree, that tells another ranger, this is something that is happening here. This is, you know, something that's going on here. And I like that, even though it doesn't actually exist in the game right now.
It's like hobo sign.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, they used to mention stuff like that where, like, if you were a ranger, rangers would, you know, like in the Forgotten Realms, would leave, like, signs saying, hey, there's a couple healing potions buried underneath this tree if you really need it. And it's kind of a neat thing there, yeah. But, you know.
So what about Druidic?
We already talked about how, like, Druidic is not as hard to learn, even though it should, you know, it is treated as this thing that is really special. I think as a magical language, it would be kind of cool if you learn Druidic or if you speak Druidic and you aren't a druid, if there was some kind of curse associated with that. And I'm not talking about like making a character completely unplayable, but just so that there's something on you where it's like, wow, I should not have done that. I should have gotten permission before I used that word. The only other thing that I would say that I would like to change is that in previous, especially like, I think this really started in third. In third edition, you had Aquan, Arran, Ignan, and Terran as the four elemental languages. And then those kind of got merged into Primordial. But what's kind of annoying is every so often, they will use one of these other terms, like this is written in Terran. But then there'll be something somewhere else saying, if you speak Primordial, you know exactly what it says in Terran. So those four other languages are meaningless because you know exactly what they all say if you know Primordial, and they all become interchangeable. And I kind of wish those were all separate languages, because it does feel weird that just because you all come from the Primordial substance that the universe is built from, there is no difference in the language in the plane of water than there is in the plane of earth, except you have a slight difference in dialect that you can easily understand. And I wish those were a little bit more different.
You know what I would do? I would say that they all speak Primordial,
mm-hmm.
but they also all speak Aquan or Ignan or whatever based on where they're from. That way you can have they can communicate with each other and there is a kind of a universal language for them. But again, like if you want to make friends with the earth elemental, speak Ignan. Or wait, is that the wrong one? Ignan would be the fire elemental.
Yes. But yeah, that's a very good point. You could use Primordial as basically your elemental plane common. All right. I think, have we talked enough about using language while we're using language to talk?
I think we have used our words enough.
No time for rest, you two. Get on with your downtime research.
Every episode, we are going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to our listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience.
So, tangentially related to D&D, but directly related to 5e, Cubicle 7 has announced the Kickstarter for Victoriana using the 5e mechanics. Victoriana is a steampunk fantasy setting that digs into a lot of the social dynamics of the period, but also does its best to avoid some of the nastier pitfalls of that era. I am particularly excited about this because I wrote an adventure for them that I'm not sure if it's coming out as part of the Kickstarter or it's something that's going to get released after the Kickstarter, but I'm told it is coming. So again, I'm super excited about this. It's basically take all your steampunk fun and Sherlockian investigations and mash it up with D&D.
I'm looking forward to it, and just to throw this out there, everything that Cubicle 7 has been doing with 5e has been pretty interesting. They were the ones that did the first Adventures in Middle-earth, which converted that to 5th edition, and that was a really neat conversion. And that's actually what gave birth to some of these things like the journey rules that they have as a separate rule set now. And then they moved into a life well lived, which is all like downtime and, you know, detail. So Cubicle 7 has really been doing some neat stuff with 5e. So I'm looking forward to seeing this. So I am going to go with something, and I'm going to mention this, but I have not had a lot of chance to mess with this. And that is the Alchemy VTT. And the main reason that I wanted to bring this up is because so many game systems are actually including Alchemy. This came out of nowhere. Like, I was not expecting a new VTT to get this much support from game companies. And on the D&D front, they do not have official support from Wizards of the Coast. However, they do already have the Tales of the Valiant rules from Kobold Press in their system. And that is ahead of any Roll20 implementation, which may someday come about after they're done creating the 5e character sheet that they're working on and deciding how to integrate companies that they keep buying without finishing up other projects that they have going on. Not that I think that's a problem, just bringing it up. But it is very interesting because Alchemy does not have the same interface that other things do. There's kind of like an isometric view, and there's kind of these weird, not weird in a bad way, but there's like these vignettes that kind of, you know, show up when you're between using battle maps and things like that. It is definitely a different style of VTT than you're probably used to. This is not the difference between like Fantasy Grounds and Roll20, where they might look similar, but it's the interface that's different. It's like, this does not even look like those.
That's interesting.
So Tales of the Valiant is already on there. I was going to say this actually gets away from 5e, but it doesn't, because Free League has a ton of stuff on there. And some of the stuff that Free League has on there is the 5e versions of their Zimbarum setting. So it is just, it's really neat. And I'm surprised at how much stuff, especially Free League, has gone like all in with them. Like all of their games are on there right now. So that's been, well, I say all of their games. I don't know if Alien is on there as much. I know like Vaisen and some of the other things like that are, though.
I wouldn't be surprised if Aliens is on there because it's the same core mechanics as Vaisen, Tales, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. I'm not surprised. I just don't remember, and I don't want to oversell that, but there is a lot from Free League's catalog that is showing up on there. And because it's interesting and because it's different, I'll just point people at that. And, you know, that could be an interesting thing for you to check out.
Interesting. Moving on out of here, we are happily part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamers podcast like
Misdirected Mark Plays. Phil, Chris, Bob, and Jerry play a custom-built Cortex Prime RPG, The Children of the Shroud. It's a story of magical high school students trying to learn how to use their powers while also keeping the magical world out of the public eye. In their actual play, not only can you hear their game sessions, you can listen to their commentary on how and why they chose the rules that they did. The story is coming to a head, which makes it a good time to start listening from the beginning to get ready for the end.
We have used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you, and we hope you'll go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.